blasts once again the national anthem of the tyrannical People's Republic of China, the Chinese Communist regime, the Chai Coms, the Red China. And today we want to discuss the People's Republic of China, its rising military threats, this rising red dragon, with John Rossomondo, who is a senior analyst for defense policy at the Center for Security Policy, and has written about China and its growing military threats to the United States and its allies in the Indo-Pacific region and beyond at the National Interest and other publications. For this episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to look at issues of the day for conservatives and others, with your show host here, Andrew Harrod. Well, John Rossomondo, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. I hope your listeners are well aware of the rising threats that China poses to Taiwan and to its immediate neighbors. The Middle Kingdom is asserting itself once more and aims to be the world's top superpower by 2049, which would be the centennial of the Declaration of the People's Republic of China.
Yes, that's right. China has announced this program looking ahead to the 100 years of the People's Republic of China, founded under Mao Zedong in 1949 at the conclusion of the Chinese Civil War, where the communists defeated the nationalists, who then had to flee to the island of Taiwan, where they maintain this Republic of China that is currently there. And the current ongoing tensions between the Republic of China regime on the island of Taiwan and the communists who have since ruled the mainland of China. Well, the Pentagon, as you have noted, the Department of Defense has, under American law, they have to report regularly on the growth of the Chinese military and its Chinese threats. And this year in 2020, they had a recent report looking that came out talking about the growth of the Chinese military. And as you've indicated, some former retired generals and admirals, flag officers from the United States military, have suggested that the United States might even lose a war with China. Well, how strong is the Chinese military today?
Well, right now China is sort of like cutting its teeth and moving from more of an insular, local, threat to trying to, be, the top power in the South China Sea. The United States Navy routinely sends, ships through the South China Sea to, challenge China's claims to sovereignty of the entire basin, which is bounded by Vietnam on the west, by the Philippines on the east, and by Malaysia and Indonesia to the south. I mean, right now, the Chinese military is nowhere near where it can compete with the U.S. I mean, the technology they have is basically a lot of like knockoff. But by 2035, the concern is that they will have matched us and exceeded us. As long as we don't remain vigilant. The election up in the air. If Biden is certified as the next president of the United States, I don't think that we can count on Biden to stay toe to toe with the communist Chinese. When Biden was a senator in the 1980s, he notoriously chided President Reagan, saying there wasn't such a thing as the Cold War when Reagan was deploying the Pershing 2s and ground launch cruise missiles to Germany.
Well, yeah, so that raises an interesting question of are we entering sort of a new kind of Cold War, as some have suggested, a new confrontation? But the report that came out from the Pentagon submitted to Congress just this year, 2020, recently noted, as you've indicated, that the Chinese Navy is actually larger than the United States Navy today in just terms of sheer tonnage. But as you're indicating, their technology is really behind, that they're still using sort of technology that's just kind of knockoffs from all the equipment they got from the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and some of which they then domestically manufactured. What sort of key technological differences are there between the United States and the Chinese?
Well, the Chinese, I'll give you an example. You know, they went and debuted their J-20 stealth fighter a decade ago. It was tracked by conventional radar by the Indian Air Force across the border during exercises over Tibet. I mean, that tells you that it's not very stealthy. Plus, also, a lot of their electronics and things like that are maybe 15 to 20 years behind the United States in terms of the technical capabilities. And they also showed during the clash with India back in June that their soldiers lack they're all conscripts, so they lack a lot of the technical capabilities that the Indians have.
Interesting. So China still is relying on conscription, whereas most modern militaries around the world have moved away from that. I mean, there really has been around the world since the end of the Cold War in particular, a professionalization of militaries. I mean, really all of Europe has given up conscription. And of course, the United States gave up conscription after the Vietnam War, and the United Kingdom also has historically not had conscription except in times of crisis wars and so forth. And they had abandoned, I guess, in the mid-1960s. And I believe also Russia no longer has conscription. Do the Chinese, is there any thought, is China going to move away from conscription towards a more professional military?
I think there's no way to know right now what China plans. But one thing we can tell is that they've been ratcheting up their rhetoric and their provocations against Taiwan, which I prefer to call Republic of China, because that would probably get under their skins, because that is the official name of Taiwan, the Republic of China. The United States needs to focus on turning Taiwan into a hedgehog of sorts. You know, something that People's Republic of China won't be able to swallow easily and will be deterred from attacking. So, President Trump recently authorized the sale of drones and of Harpoon anti-ship missiles to Taiwan. One thing that I really am a supporter of is selling the F-35 fighter to Taiwan, because it would add to element of surprise to the Taiwanese Air Force. One of the first things that the PRC would do if they were to invade Taiwan is to bomb its military airports and to knock them out. So giving them the F-35B version will give them vertical takeoff landing capabilities to engage the Chinese Air Force.
Uh-huh. Yes, you wrote about that at the National Interest with the F-35, with the variant that has this vertical short takeoff and landing, or landing a VSTOL capability, that then similar to, say, Sweden in the past, historically during the Cold War and afterwards, Taiwanese would have a capability to launch aircraft from roads and highways, something that Sweden has traditionally prepared for, among other countries, to use as highways, as airfields in times of emergency, any conflict. Well, how would you assess the military balance between mainland People's Republic of China and the Republic of China on Taiwan? What sort of military threats could the Chinese communist regime undertake against Taiwan?
Well, basically a lot of psychological warfare. I mean, Sun Tzu said, the greatest stratagem in warfare is to get your opponent to surrender without a shot. Right now, the morale in the Taiwanese military is very low. The chances of you know, I think that they would be very hard pressed to, you know, repel an invasion. Although, you know, there are certain elements of the geography of Taiwan that make it less you know, susceptible. One of the things that, you know, Admiral James Winnefeld, you know, former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said on a webinar that I did about a month ago, was that, you know, we should work in giving them intelligent mines and so forth to put in the sea to make it hard for the Chinese, you know, People's Liberation Army Navy to land their Marines on Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. You say that the morale of the Taiwanese military, the Republic of China, is not very good. I've often heard in the past people talk about the prospects of China trying to attack Taiwan. They've said that, you know, some people have joked about it being a so-called million-man swim, that China, just even today, still does not really have the capability to undertake a massive amphibious assault, and that Taiwan, which has, if I recall correctly, some 21 million people, would be able to field a military that could stop a Chinese assault. Why do you say that the Taiwanese military has low morale?
Because there have been reports about the lack of equipment, the poor morale in the Taiwanese army. You know, those are things that to take into account. I mean, the People's Liberation Army Navy commissioned one of their first landing craft is kind of like our WASP class LHDs, landing helicopter dock ship that can send out landing craft. But maybe they're not there today in 2020, but the fear is that maybe 2030, 2035, they might be able to do so. I mean, the other threat comes from Chinese bombers and cruise missiles. The Chinese have S-400 anti-aircraft missiles they've gotten from the Russians that can shoot down Taiwanese aircraft from the mainland. So that's what the calculus is at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So definitely then there needs to be an upgrade of Taiwanese forces, although I found it interesting that apparently Taiwan, in their defense spending, they only spend about less than 2% of their GDP, if I remember that correctly, from this Pentagon report. And for that matter, China also only spends less than 2% of its GDP, although its defense expenditures have been rising in the past couple of decades. And, of course, that's 2% of such a massive economy in China, which really goes then a much longer way. Are the Taiwanese seeking to increase their defense spending?
That's one of the, I haven't looked into that. That's a good question. But I think that they should. I think that, we should also, help to, find, donors or other countries to help to subsidize their ability to defend themselves, and maybe trying to foster closer relations with, say, Indonesia, which is an oil producer that's also feeling pressured by China in the South China Sea or other nations could possibly help.
Mm-hmm. How do the Taiwanese feel about these threats? Is there a sense in Taiwan that they're really under threat, or do they somehow, in their calculations, they think, no, nothing's really going to change?
Well, I think that there's a lot of uncertainty going on. The Taiwanese, signed an inked deal earlier this year to obtain a new model of the F-16, to defend themselves. The People's Republic of China has complained to the Trump administration about their effort But I think that a big wild card is if Biden is, certified, if he will, sort of back away from, robust support of Taiwan against the People's Republic of China, because, there's a lot of, there are trillions of dollars of, economic interdependence between our two countries.
Well, thinking of Taiwan, what other steps do you think the United States or other countries, as you've indicated, should take to strengthen Taiwan's position, like, say, in the diplomatic realm? Should we upgrade our relations with Taiwan? Or what other steps might countries take to strengthen Taiwan's position?
It's like, the idea, if you would have asked me a week ago, would have said, if Trump's reelected, that he should use the threat of upgraded, diplomatic relations with Taiwan as a chip to try to, compel China sort of to back down. That would be but now with Biden as, the likely winner of the presidential election, that all bets are off. President Biden would be more willing to acquiesce to the demands of the Chinese Communist Party, because it's all about money. That's the only thing that I can see that they care about is money.
Yeah, sort of like, what the NBA is doing or so forth. If you criticize China and the NBA, the economic pressure comes and, they silence you if you tweet out something about Hong Kong or so I guess, yeah, similar forces would predominate in the Democratic Party. Well, what other flashpoints are there aside from Taiwan in the Pacific? Like you mentioned the South China Sea Islands. Where else would the United States and its allies come into conflict with China?
There's also the threat, the Chinese and Japan have clashed over sovereignty of the Senkaku Islands, which are just to the north of Taiwan. The Chinese claim them, and the Japanese claim them. Japan has been pressured to increase some of its defense commitments. It recently finished upgrading its helicopter carrier to carry the F-35 as its first sort of aircraft carrier since World War II. That's where I see it, but I think a lot of the issues we're going to deal with China is also going to be like in space. With the threat, that their anti-satellite weaponry and their lasers, but also, it's the area of cyber warfare. And that's a huge thing. We really need to work on, ramping up our cyber capabilities to not just go and be defensive against China, but also to use it both for like espionage and to obtain a better look at Chinese technology.
Right. Yeah. Those are all, certainly in confrontation with China in the modern world, wherever we might confront China, then the ultimate high ground, the ultimate level of conflict will come into space or into cyber warfare. Those will be key elements in countering China. I've written, for example, specifically about issues of China's growing competition with the United States in space. Thinking of the Senkaku Islands, why are China and Japan disputing the islands? What is particularly valuable about the islands, or what sort of historic claims do Japan and China have to these islands?
Japan obtained the islands as a result of the 1896 Sino-Japanese War, in which Japanese also occupied Taiwan, which was called Formosa at the time, And China is really trying to reassert sovereignty over lost territories, including, ironically, against Russia. The area that where Vladivostok, the famous Russian naval base, originally was part of China until about 1860 when it was obtained from China due to an unequal treaty. I talked with a very high-level State Department official who said in his discussion with the Russians that, in the long term, they, have concerns that China will want to, take that territory back. I mean, it's a very low population. So, the Chinese, lots of Chinese workers have been migrating across the Yalu River into Russia. And in some places, ethnic Chinese are starting to outnumber Russians.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect that's been talked about really since, particularly since the end of the Cold War, but brings up issues going back to the Cold War when you had the Sino-Soviet split, that these two communist giants, the Soviet Union on the one hand and the People's Republic of China on the other hand, in the 1960s, really broke apart, and America wanted to play that China card under Nixon when he visited China in 1972 and then initiated the process that led under Jimmy Carter in 1979 to the United States recognizing the People's Republic of China as the government of China and de-recognizing Taiwan, the Republic of China. And then we had greater contacts with China, and you actually had a fighting between China and the Soviet Union, particularly in 1969, in nearby Vladivostok, but along that northern border with China, along the Umri River, if I'm saying that right correctly. But this is a question that people have noted that since the end of the Cold War, Russia continues to have this rather significant arms relationship with China. They're still selling all these advanced weapons to China, like the S-400 anti-aircraft missiles. And yet, as you and others have indicated, there could be a lot of conflict here. I mean, with all this population migration in formerly Chinese territories, China might someday want to try to take a grab for some of these territories that long in the past had been Chinese but are now under Russian control. Are the Russians, when we think of any rising Chinese military threats, are the Russians giving any thought to this as to whether they're going to confront China or whether they want to keep selling advanced weapons to the Chinese?
Well, I think that the Russians are more interested in their place in the world, and they see the Chinese sort of as an enemy of my enemy kind of thing to head off the United States. That's their calculus, but there's also been a lot of tension back and forth from the Russian side, because back in the 1990s, Boris Yeltsin sold them Su-27 fighters that the Chinese promptly made knockoffs of. The Chinese have been trying to get more technology. And the Russians have been kind of a little bit more skittish about giving it because they're notorious pirating.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese copies of the Su-27 are hardly equivalent to the Russians because their engines are terrible.
Mm-hmm. I see. So the Chinese have begun to domestically manufacture now the Su-27 flanker, as it's called by the NATO code name, which has been in recent decades Russia's top of the line fighter, along with the MiG-29 Fulcrum.
Mm-hmm. Russians have several versions of the Su-27. They recently came out with the MiG-35, which is an upgraded version of the MiG-29. As far as I know, only the Russian Air Force is using. But, I mean, in terms of, technological capability, I'd say that the Russian equipment is superior to the Chinese. But, you know, the Chinese have a more powerful economy than the Russians do. So, you know, when I hear people talk about, oh, you know, the Russians, the Russian economy is, you know, a fraction of ours or a fraction of the Chinese. Due to the sanctions, they can't really afford much. I mean, they were supposed to field a new stealth fighter, and, you know, they really haven't been able to do so because their economics are don't hold up. I mean, Russia might be a threat to its immediate neighbors, but not on the level of China.
Well, also, apparently China's been receiving recently the Su-35 fighters. Could you tell us more about that? What is the nature of that plane? Apparently, it's a development of the Su-27.
Well, more modern avionics and more capable. I mean, yeah, even with our own Air Force, the F-22 20 years ago. Is not the F-22 of today because, you know, we've made continual improvements in armaments and sensors. No doubt they've done the same.
Mm-hmm. And thinking of, we discussed earlier the J-20 stealth fighter, which is China, you know, is trying to tout as their equivalent of the F-22. And indeed, if you look at photographs of the J-20, it looks really similar to the F-22 in its outline. But as you noted, the Indian Air Force was able to track this on their radar, so maybe it's not all that it's up to scratch. Have the Chinese, as you say, they've been pirating Russian technology, have they been able to pirate American technology to build things like their J-20 stealth fighter?
One of the theories was that if you remember back in 1999, you had the shoot down of the F-117 in Yugoslavia. And the theory is that the wreckage made its way back to China, and China, you know, is really good at reverse engineering. I mean, just to give you another example, back in the 1990s, like 99, they purchased the former Soviet carrier Varyag, which was two-thirds complete at the end of the Soviet Union, and it was just a hulk via holding company. They went and modernized it, and it's now serving in the Chinese Navy as the Liaoning. And they just, commissioned, the Shandong, which is a copy of that aircraft carrier. So, the Chinese are really good at reverse engineering things, which is one of the tensions between Russia and China, is that, Russia will give them stuff, then they'll just reverse engineer it and, create a knockoff.
That's interesting. So you say the Shandong is purely domestically produced in China, and that's just purely through reverse engineering of the previous Varig, which the Chinese bought from Russia after the Cold War and then put into service. So they just simply went ahead without any Russian support and reverse engineered.
They received the blueprints when they bought it from Ukraine. You know, this was right at the end after the Soviet Union. And like Russia, you know, Ukraine was bankrupt. So, holding company purchased the vessel. And, if you look at the Shandong, it looks very similar to the Liaoning, at least as the Chinese rebuilt it.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And that's I didn't realize that. That's interesting that they just simply they had the blueprints when they bought it from Ukraine after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. You had then a lot of the Soviet Navy was stationed in Crimea under in Ukrainian territory, and there was a negotiation with Russia as to how much of the fleet that Ukraine would get in this breakdown of the Soviet Union. And so the Chinese were basically then able to just simply go ahead and build another one domestically without really any particular Russian development. That's really interesting. Well, what about with America? What thinking then of the F-22 or you mentioned the F-117 in that shootdown during the Kosovo air campaign of 1998, the Serbs were able to shoot down one F-117 flying over Serbia into targets around Belgrade and elsewhere, which really surprised, as I recall, remembering that air campaign, the Americans, that the Serbs were able to somehow concentrate their radars into one particular sector so that they could really, they could still pick up the F-117 and shoot one down. And I knew a person who used to live in my building who was in the same squadron and had to go on a combat mission right the day after that plane got shot down. Are there any other examples of where the Chinese have been able to sort of pirate or steal or acquire American technology that has shown up in their military defense efforts?
Well, last year, John Bolton, before he was ousted as National Security Advisor, called out the Chinese for stealing the plans of the F-35, which showed up in another Chinese stealth fighter design. At least if you look at the front of it, is very similar to the F-35. But just because they have the plan doesn't mean that they can simply go out there and manufacture F-35s to the same standards as NATO and the U.S. Air Force.
Right. Yeah. That's a key. Yeah. In all of these technological issues, it's a key issue of there's more to it than just having a blueprint or something. It's always a very complicated process involving things like your manufacturing capabilities, what machines you have, or skills, or what materials you can develop. Well, thinking about other flashpoints, you mentioned earlier the South China Sea. What sort of particular conflicts are there in the South China Sea that would involve the United States and its allies? What's the importance of the South China Sea? What resources are there, and what sort of disputed claims you have there of islands and territories there?
Well, you have the oil-rich and resource-rich Spratly Islands, which are in the middle of the South China Sea. I mean, people have been talking about Chinese designs on those islands at least since the 1990s. They've built military bases down there and have claimed sovereignty over those islands, and which the United States rejects. Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia all have claims there. So it's kind of like, China is the 800-pound gorilla. And who knows where things could end up going. I read back in the spring, the Chinese claimed that they chased an American destroyer out of an area they claimed in the South China Sea off the coast of Vietnam.
Well, how would if that's been an ongoing issue that China has been trying to develop these sort of bases on like various small islands or atolls and reefs, and they trying to build them out with say concrete and other materials and enlarge them. How should the United States approach such issues of this 800-pound gorilla of China really asserting its claims over these territories and just simply going ahead and claiming it?
Well, I just think it just remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of, question marks out there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed to me that, China's just sort of going ahead. Would America ever have any interest? I guess Americans would ultimately, I can't really see Americans wanting to say, engage in a military conflict over such territories. I mean, we would have, perhaps no more interest to do that than to engage in a military conflict with Turkey over Cyprus, in its 1974 invasion of the island and seizure of the northern Turkish part of Cyprus during the ongoing communal tension between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots in Cyprus. I mean, is there really anything more the United States could do than just sort of, sanctions or economic pressure or protests, or, you know, we can simply, I guess, in terms of the freedom of the seas, we could move our ships to that area and still assert a right to simply sail through the region for ourselves and others. But so would that be all that America would ever do?
I just think that the United States thing that I'm working on is emphasizing the need to maintain a strong Navy. You know, we need to increase our number of ships and capabilities to deter the growing threat of the Chinese Navy. It's sort of like we need to focus on deterrence, you know, whether it's like nuclear deterrence, whether it's, naval deterrence in terms of having enough ships to confront whatever, we might threat. We need to be able to be in multiple places at the same time.
Well, yeah, that's another interesting thing you've written about the national interest. One particular thing you focus on is that you propose that the United States should build a new modern stealth battleship, a kind of a heavily armored ship that could be a weapons platform for all sorts of missiles or perhaps even new forms of guns. Describe that for our listeners here.
Well, one of the things, back during the early 1980s, President Reagan was confronted with the commissioning of the Russian Kirov battle cruiser that was armed with an overwhelming number of anti-ship missiles, and it was thought that the Iowa-class battleships, with their thick armor, would be able to, repel, or some of those missiles, which which were designed to be hit by armor-piercing shells that weighed up to 2,000 pounds or something like that. And my proposal was to have something that combines stealth, which would give it a small radar signature, armor. Thick armor so that they could take it. But, you know, the basic thing would be is that this would be this ship would have hundreds of different kinds of missiles for different targets, whether, anti-ship, anti-land, also armed with, whether it's, a high-power, conventional guns that would have the long range and the ability to fire something equivalent to a 16-inch shell. One thing that you can't do with a shell that's coming at you is you can't jam it. You can't shoot it down because the Chinese don't have the technology. But if you're able to be like 100 miles away and your gun's blazing and be able to hit those ships at the the enemy ships outside the range, it'd be hard for them to strike back. You want to hit overwhelming force.
So you're saying a new gun? Well, what range again would such guns on a new battleship have? I mean, historically, if you think of, like, as you mentioned, the Iowa class that were brought back in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan from having been built in World War II and having served in World War II, and then later also in Korea, for example, the USS Wisconsin shelled North Korean positions, and then also in Vietnam where the New Jersey was brought back to engage in gunfire support of targets in Vietnam. What sort of new range would the any big guns on a new battleship have? Would it be beyond
Right now, the U.S. Army is working on developing a long range, conventional gun that could hit hundreds of miles away. So no, and the guns that are employed on the Zoom wall class are designed to hit like 60 miles away. You know, the rail guns. But I think that it would be useful to work on technology to arm these post-stealth battleships with guns that could hit like well beyond the 25 miles of the Iowas and maybe upwards to like 60 to 100 miles.
Really, I hadn't heard of that. So the Army is developing guns that can hit 100 miles?
Well, we're more than that. Like there's one gun they're proposing and working on developing that could hit 1,000 miles.
Really? And
so
is
basically...
that, I mean...
Yes,
yeah,
so
will...
basically you would be able to shell Chicago from D.C. or something like that.
And how feasible is that, or how long will it take to develop something like that?
Well, they're currently testing.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's an extraordinary range. I've never heard of that before. That's really new to me that you could develop that. And then, of course, such a battleship would have also missile batteries. So you say the key advantage of such a battleship with its weapons is that unlike say missiles fired from an airplane or off an aircraft carrier or missiles fired from a submarine, that you just simply can't jam a shell.
Right, but the thing is it still would be designed to have hundreds of vertical launch cells for whether cruise missiles, anti-ship missiles and whatever mission that would be required. I mean, the thing is that you would overwhelm the enemy's defenses, whether they're at sea or ashore. But I definitely would say that we should look at upgraded guns because you can't jam a shell. You can use electronic warfare countermeasures to jam a missile. Get it, just make it think that, your ship is someplace it's not. I mean, the other thing that I would include on this, stealth battleship would be a strong electronic warfare capability to jam enemy missiles and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And would such a battleship, would such a battleship really be focused mainly on any sort of Chinese contingency fighting the Chinese, or would it have other uses as well against other opponents, like, Iran
or
Russia?
It would be for Iran, Russia. I mean, it's a force projection tool. It's a psychological, kind of a weapon system. I mean, it's more, the Russians use their Kirov class, a battle cruiser, sort of, for that purpose. After the Georgia crisis, they dispatched the Kirov-class battlecruiser, Peter the Great, to Venezuela. And that caused a little bit of stir for the United States Navy, seeing that ship being deployed because it can project hundreds of anti-ship missiles and other weapons.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the mass firepower, but of course with a battleship type system, the big difference is, the Kirov doesn't have any armament. It's just as weakly armed, has just as much weak armament as any other ship, whereas a battleship could really survive hits from missiles like from the Kirov, which was the whole idea then back
right.
in the 80s.
Right. The idea is that you have something that is survivable, that can take a lot of hits. I mean, just look at the HMS Sheffield. It was sunk by an Exocet missile with a 200-pound warhead. The USS Stark was badly damaged by an Iraqi Exocet in 1987. President Reagan responded to that by dispatching the USS Missouri. And XO executive officer of the Missouri was like, if we were to get hit by the Exocet, it would just basically make do superficial damage.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in the Falklands War, the Argentine Air Force was of course able to do significant damage to the British. I mean, you had the Sheffield sunk by an Exocet, and then later a key merchant ship in the British Navy, the Atlantic Conveyor, where the British had the bulk of their heavy helicopters, their Chinooks, was then sunk, and so that meant that the British lost a lot of their heavy Chinook helicopter lift. They only had one surviving Chinook helicopter. The other three got sunk on the Atlantic Conveyor. And then, of course, in bombing attacks by the Argentine Air Force with regular 500-pound bombs, they sank another sister ship of the Sheffield, the HMS Coventry, and then two frigates, the Ardent and Antelope, as well as then they attacked the landing craft of the British during a landing along the Falklands, the HMS Fearless. So, yeah, there were pretty heavy British naval losses in that Falklands War just from air attack with bombs and missiles, showing again that these ships and they really can't withstand any damage. But that's a fundamental difference with the Iowa class battleships like the Missouri. Well, thinking about looking at strategic forces, what role do you think America's missile defense should play in dealing with rising Chinese threats?
Well, I think that the United States needs to work on developing space-based interceptors to counter the threat from Chinese and Russian hypersonics. That was something, right now we don't have any defense against the hypersonic nuclear glide vehicles that could be launched by a Chinese or a Russian ballistic missile. So I think that some of the things that were considered as under Reagan's SDI need to be dusted off and put into use, even if it takes like 10, 15 years. We need to work on upgrading our land-based missile interceptors in Alaska and California, also putting them on the East Coast to counter, whether it's threats from Iran in the event that Iran develops ICBMs, which is, likely where they're headed. I mean, if you look at North Korea and most of the Iranian missile technology is North Korean, which actually is Chinese via North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another area. China and Iran have, reached an agreement in August to increase their military ties. With the Chinese, the Iranians are looking for funds. They can get them from the Chinese. Plus also, they're looking to maybe send like 5,000 Chinese troops to Iran and give them ports on the Iranian side of the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, so a lot of growing contact there. So I guess that just highlights the need for even more development of missile defense. And that ties into a question you the Department of Defense report noted that China's nuclear arsenal is going to grow, that they currently apparently have some 200 warheads that could hit the United States. That's going to, or if I'm reading that correctly, the figures from the report was that their nuclear force is expected to grow in the next 5 years to about roughly 200 warheads on missiles that can hit the United States. Now, you've talked about getting China to be a part of nuclear arms negotiations, given this growing nuclear threat from China. What could the United States do to get China to join in any nuclear arms agreements?
Well, I think what the United States needs to do is work at increasing our nuclear dominance in East Asia, whether it's placing intermediate ballistic missiles in Alaska, Guam, also increasing the threat, so that they start feeling a little bit of heat from us, being like they've been really ramping up their missile development, et cetera. I'm sure that you saw the propaganda video of a simulated Chinese attack on U.S. forces in Guam. So, there's a lot of propaganda value there. I mean, I think that anything that would increase the, pressure, the psychological pressure on the Chinese would be useful.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would having intermediate range missiles in Alaska, I mean, I guess just in total, we still have an overwhelming advantage over China. The American strategic nuclear force, I guess both Russia and the United States have agreed to limit themselves under the START II agreement from George W. Bush, that we would limit ourselves to 1,000 strategic nuclear weapons. So I guess we're still in a dominant position. Does moving missiles to Alaska change anything in the particular dominance of the United States?
I just think that in terms of repositioning our assets, so that they know that these nuclear missiles are directed at them. I mean, and all the same, if you increase it, you're also threatening Russia. A lot of just watched the Russian territory. So I think that, working to develop an overmatch. I mean, one of the things I proposed in my most recent article was going back to the MX system that was developed in the 1980s that created mobile launchers, so that the Soviets wouldn't be able to know where our missiles were, and they wouldn't be able to target our silos. Right now, the Russians, I don't know how accurate the Chinese are, but I know that the Russians can easily target our silos, which is why some people have called for scaling back to a sea-based, submarine-based nuclear deterrent by itself. So I think that we need to have the bombers. We need to have the new generation of ICBMs. And I think that we need to remind the Chinese that we can overmatch them, and that it's not in their interest to continue to increase their nuclear forces, because it would be a no-win for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess that then raises issues of sort of repeating the experience with Ronald Reagan during the Cold War, peace through strength, that we can win an arms competition with an opponent. We can really grind you down. Is that a possibility then for China? Could we really say to the Chinese, look, you just don't want to engage in an arms competition with us. It's really going to hurt you.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's what, what President Trump gains, that's what he's after. So if President Trump, manages to prevail in court against Joe Biden, that's what a second Trump administration would look like. Because Trump envisions himself as the new Reagan. Joe Biden, was against every single nuclear arms upgrade and modernization in the 1980s.
Right. Well, how would China, if we think of China today in comparison to the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union really was collapsing under this communist regime. It was, its economy was just terrible. Marxism was not working. Also, the Soviet Union really was an empire threatened with all of these peoples, the Central Asia and the Ukrainians and the Baltics and everyone wanting to break away. But here with China, we have a much more economically vigorous society, really a growing society, much more unified with a single Chinese nation and over 1 billion people. would China be much more willing to say, look, we're just becoming really powerful. We'll take you on in an arms race.
Well, I think that one of the things that we need to do is, work on our own active measures against the Chinese to, enhance social tensions between the Han and the other ethnic groups, and to, work at, making it hard for Chinese Communist Party to govern the country. And that's what Admiral Winnefeld had said on my podcast, on my webinar last month.
Mm-hmm. So you have to have similar strategies of, you have to not let China get away with just growing in its strength, but really say, look, we're going to penalize you if you're going to engage in this global competition with us, with these global threats. We can, what would be a full range of options? I guess you could say, you've mentioned you can promote sort of freedom movements among like say in Tibet or among the Uyghurs, or, promote say a pro-democracy movements in like Hong Kong or throughout China. What about trade sanctions that would really lose support among the Chinese regime if they can no longer have this growing economy?
Right. I sort of we have a whole range of options, but whether a President Biden would do that, I find it highly unlikely. Senator Biden, opposed President Reagan on every effort to put the screws on the Soviet Union. I mean, this is who Joe Biden is. He will be a weakling. He will be an appeaser, both to China, and now we have news that Vladimir Putin is going to step down in January. So there's no way that a Joe Biden administration will hold any of our adversaries to account. He will be an appeaser. He will look at peace at any cost, kind of like a very Neville Chamberlain kind of way.
Well, let's see. We like to, when we have people call in, we like to answer caller questions. That we might have a caller here. A caller, do you have a question that you would like to ask John Rossomondo here in the closing minutes of the show? Caller, are you out there? No. Well, in closing out here, John, why don't you? What are then the prospects? Can we, if we look at a rising confrontation with China, what are the ultimate prospects for bringing any sort of liberalization or regime change in China, and to have a more cooperative, more pacifist, more benign China that people have been hoping for since all the way back to the days of when, in the 1990s under Clinton and then later under George W. Bush, that we've been seeking with measures that would try to integrate China into the world and reform China? What should we look forward in the future in dealing with this long-term threat?
Well, I think that we should work on repaying them with their cyber warfare that they've been waging against us by targeting their great wall, their internet great wall. I mean, we're seeing the rise here of the great wall of information that these tech companies are putting on us. But we should work at increasing information to the Chinese people. It worked in the Eastern Bloc in the 1980s, where we were able to provide information to Solidarity and to the various anti-communist movements in the Eastern Bloc, and eventually they crumbled. So now, the more information that we can let the Chinese people obtain, the more that we'll be able to destabilize China and hopefully bring about the end of the Communist Party.
Well,
maybe a couple of decades.
Yeah, that would be hopefully that we can have a repeat of the collapse of the Soviet bloc that ultimately happened peacefully internally with the domestic breakdown of of these communist dictatorships. Well, John Rossomondo, I'm very glad that you've joined us from the Center for Security Policy for another episode here of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to look at issues of the day for conservatives and others. So I hope our listeners will join me next week with your show host, Andrew Herod, as we have another episode to look at these issues. Thank you very much, John Rossomondo, for joining us today on the show.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Andrew.
Bye-bye.